Hi, thank you. My name is Maren Harwood, grateful recovered alcoholic. Thanks, guys, for coming out in the rain. Visitor from out of town. This is cool. I like this group. I like this meeting. I like the reading in the beginning where we're remembered to think about the price of our last drink. I think that's an interesting thought process, right? What's the price? Dollar amount is what they mean. I look at it a little bit different. Right. What was the price of my last drink? Turns out that was the price of admission to freedom. Turns out, right? During that time when it was happening, it didn't feel like that, right? There were some things that had to get done in order to achieve, as it says in the book, right, that cornerstone and created that archway we walked to freedom, right? I didn't see it that way. I saw it as you were taking away my solution, right? You were taking away the one thing I had found that had given me a sense of ease and comfort. Right, so just an interesting concept to think of the price of that we pay for the last one. So, all right. So the last few weeks we've been kind of walking through some step work. Last week we talked about the fourth step. We discussed inventory, what resentment inventory looks like, and how it describes it in the book as a four-column inventory. Then we looked at the fear inventory. That's a typical two-column. And we look at where self-reliance had failed us there. And then as far as sex conduct goes, again, four-column inventory. We look at the parts of ourselves, right, that had been lacking in certain areas. Where were we inconsiderate, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid, right? We leaked a little bit into step nine, but we won't do that today. What we're going to do today is we're going to discuss what happens after the inventory, right? So the purpose and the way the book is designed, the way the book was designed is to be mailed out to somebody's house, right? And they receive the book there and they read it and they do what it says, right? That's the idea. So before, in the way the book is designed, before any other alcoholic or anyone else is to come into play, you're actually supposed to have had a written inventory at that point. Because if I'm doing the book as it describes, it doesn't tell me to literally meet up with or link up with anybody. Because there wasn't AA around the corner when this book was written. It was printed in 1939. There weren't groups all over the place, right? The most authority you'd find in higher power or God territory was your local church, synagogue, mosque. You know, it's like that was your best bet. And so at this point is when they start to introduce someone else into the alcoholic step work, and that would be step five. Right, so after we have a written inventory, it starts off step five on page 72, into action. I love this chapter only because it encompasses steps 5 through 11, the bulk of the step work in one chapter. And it doesn't say into contemplation. Let me remind you. It doesn't say into thinking or to delay anything. It literally tells us that we've got to get into action, okay? So having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? There you go. There's a question, right, that the reader is asking themselves. It's going to give explicit and exact directions on what to do with your inventory. We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects and have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. How about that little hidden promise? Right? I mean, it just kind of tucks it in there. Right? Here's the shortcomings. Here's some things that the obstacles was blocking you from getting this relationship with a Creator or whatever you want to call it. Right? And these are the obstacles that are on your path. Very kind of just great descriptive wording that anyone can understand. This is blocking me from walking and going where I need to go. Right? And we put our finger on those weak items. Now they're about to be cast out. Like the question is always like, well, when? It just told me. Now they're about to be cast out. This is extremely vital, right? And I don't think he accidentally put this in there. This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. This is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we have done well enough admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. All we need to do to understand that sentence is to think back. We may not have written an inventory, but when we appraise ourselves in a certain way, we typically put a better light on it than what's really the case or really the truth, right? I could do an appraisal on somebody else, no problem, right? And I could figure out what's going on with them. But when I turn the mirror back on me, I tend to only see the good stuff. I miss out on the other stuff, right? So in actual practice, right, that's the part of the sentence that's really important. In actual practice, we usually find solitary self-appraisal insufficient. So when we actually do it, a self-appraisal, it's not sufficient. It doesn't come up with the right or real answers for us. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We'll be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reason why we should do so. The best reason first. Here we go. Here's Bill, a sales guy. He's going to try to convince you on why you should share it with another person and not just keep it to yourself. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Well, that's a good one. Right? I mean, and vital means life-giving, right? So if we skip this step, we may not overcome drinking. And if you're a real alcoholic, to drink is to die. Right? I mean, that's what my book tells me. Not only that, that's what I've experienced. Not just, I'm not talking about obviously physical death. We're talking about spiritual death. Right? When the alcoholic is sober for a little while and drinks again, the spirit dies because a new spirit comes in. Wine and spirits. Right? That other alcohol spirit. Right? When that comes in, you can't have both. We can't be running on both cylinders. Unfortunately, it's got to be one or the other, right? So it's the spiritual death, and that's kind of the in the figurative sense. And obviously, right, the way things are going even today, there's a literal death for folks, and it happens a lot, unfortunately. So if we skip this vital step, meaning life-giving step, we may not overcome drinking. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods, like not saying anything. Keep it, right? Like keeping it to ourselves, right? That seems a little easier, right? I don't want someone else to know about what's going on with me. And you'll see why. Again, each step as we go through after the third step reverts back to the third step. And you'll see as we get to the next paragraph when we do that. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. Interesting how we put that in, right? So it's well enough. They wrote an inventory. They decided not to share it with anyone else. And then they went through with the rest of the program and wondered why they fell. It's quite literally because they weren't able to be honest with another person about what was going on. We think the reason they never completed their house cleaning, right? That's another way to look at step five, right? You made your house cleaning, you did your inventory with step four. The only way to finish it is to share it with somebody else, right? So it kind of ties the two steps together, and in order to complete one, you have to complete the other. Right, so it marries them in a sense with that sentence right there. They took inventory, all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. Again, important squiggly letters. Smart people call it italics, right? The word thought twice, right? Again, every time I relapsed, I did it sober. My brain is where the problem is. So if I'm only thinking I'm okay, or I'm thinking that I had lost my egoism and fear, if I'm only thinking that I had humbled myself, I'm in big trouble, right? Because, again, my solitary self-appraisal is going to be like, oh, I wrote it all down, I'm good. Like, hey, you know, oh, I must be rid of fear or it kills me. Great, I'm going to get rid of fear now. Like, and then moving on, not completing the house cleaning or inventory. But they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty. In a sense, we find it necessary until they tell someone else all their life story. Here's where it reverts back to the third step. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. Interesting how it's talking about the parallel, the difference between the mind and the heart. Right, I only think I got rid of my egoism and fear, but in my heart I know I didn't. Right, so that's the blockage. Right, that's why we write an inventory. We write an inventory is to connect. Right, our brain got us far enough. Right, to walk into AA, but there was no connection to the heart, so we weren't able to connect to the spirit within us. So that's where the inventory comes in and sees the stuff that's blocking us, or as it just told me, the obstacles in the path. Right? Once we see the obstacles in the path, that's all well and good, but if we're not sharing it with someone else, we're just basically listing our issues or our problems. It's like I look at a sink full of dirty dishes and I say, hey, there's a sink full of dirty dishes, I'm going to go sit on the couch. Right? I've noticed the issue. I've seen the obstacle in getting to the sink, but I'm not doing anything about that. Right? I aim somewhere else. It's the same thing with the inventory. Okay, all right, I'll admit it. I've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking. I've been fearful in all my relationships. I haven't been considerate of anybody, and I have barely been honest with anyone at all. All right, great. Right? In my head, I'm doing this. All right, great. I just won't do that anymore. Move on. As opposed to sitting down with somebody else who might be able to share some insight that you may not see. My perception when looking at myself is like looking through a straw. I have one little point of view. I'm unable to really take a look at myself from an entirely different angle without the help of God and somebody else. I'm going to have a very difficult time doing that. So, again, the double life stage character reverts back to step three between pages 60 and 63, where it discusses the actor who's trying to arrange the lights, the ballet. If everything would only go as I say, it's going to be fine. Notice how he reverts back to that, because that's what we'd be doing if we don't share it with somebody else. If we don't share the inventory with somebody else, we're playing God again. Right, saying I can figure this out. I've got this. I know what the obstacles are. Right, I see the sink. It's okay. There we go. And then not doing something about it again. Into action is what the chapter we're talking about. Right, and it's not into psychoanalysis or wondering why or questioning. And it's not, none of those things. We have to take action now. This is where the proverbial rubber meets the road. Right, and until that happens, it just told me we're gonna have very little chance of recovery. Right, this is a vital step in doing so. So these next couple paragraphs discuss, you know, kind of the medical fraternity and how they don't necessarily have good odds for our recovery. They're not big fans of because we come in and we come out. We pay them to lie to them, and there's all sorts of things that come around with this. Now it's also going to talk about who we would share it with. Right. So again, historical context when the book was written. Right? There wasn't an AA meeting around every corner. You couldn't accidentally walk into a church basement and stumble into an AA meeting. Just wasn't the case. So what would you do? You'd go to probably a higher authority. You might go to your local church and you might do a confession. You might set up time with them however you might go about it. It also says, well, you might find, you know, a closed-mouthed understanding friend, or, you know, it's giving them ideas on who to share it with. Because at this time, they might be the only person in their little town in the Midwest that has one of these books and is understanding what it's going to be taking to get well. So they would go share it with them. So then when they go find another alcoholic to help, they're going to be the one naturally to hear that person's inventory. Right? So they have to give this information this way because there wasn't a bunch of AAs around to be able to find. Now it says on the bottom of 74, notwithstanding the great necessity for discussing ourselves with someone, it might be someone so situated where there's no suitable person available. This is not an out. I'm only reading this because no one's getting an out here, right? If that is so, which is rare today, but if that was so in this, what does it tell me? This step may be postponed only, however, a lot of comma use here, Bill, like only, however, if we hold ourselves in complete readiness to go through it at the first opportunity. We say this because we are very anxious that we talk with the right person. It is important that he is able to keep a confidence, that he fully understands and approves what we are driving at, and that he does not try to change our plan. But we must not use this as a mere excuse to postpone. Right? So it's trapping me here a little bit, right? So imagine in 1942 I have this book and it's like, okay, I got this inventory, but I gotta share it with the right person. Right? And I'm postponing. Then what's it tell me I'm gonna do? I'm probably gonna drink again. Right? So if I take the beginning part of this chapter serious, right, then I'm gonna find someone to share it with. Now this excuse is kind of gone. If you think about it, you make a meeting a week, you're going to stumble across somebody who'd be a perfect person, a perfect candidate to hear your inventory, right? Typically, in the beginning, when the newcomer walks in the room, what our book advises us to do is to approach them and offer them a solution. Like what my sponsor did with me. He walked up to me and said, I'm sponsoring you. Right? Do you have a book? That's basically how it went. Because that's the way the book describes. We're supposed to approach the newcomer, not the other way around. Nowhere in the book does it say, go out and find a sponsor. But at this time, it's telling us to go out and find someone who we can share our inventory with. And if there happen to be AA meetings around, then maybe you go out and find a sponsor that way. But again, it really just depends. It's a case-by-case basis. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory, and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we are about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. Okay? So again, it's emphasizing how important, use the word vital first. Now it's saying life or death. Right? He's trying to hammer home a point. This is very important to do. Right? And just because I have it written down and I looked at it and even maybe even shared it with God in that moment, because if God is all present, then he, she, or it was there when I wrote the thing. Okay, so I've got 2 out of 3, ain't bad. Right? However, it's telling us how vital and important and life-giving this is. All right? Now, here come fifth step promises. These are some of the promises in the book are beautiful. These are some really, 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 really good ones. We pocket our pride and go to it. There's our caveat. As long as we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past, once we have taken the step with holding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we are beginning to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway. Notice again, capitalized and implies God, right? So, and I mentioned this last couple weeks, but when Bill wrote the book, he used 3 references. He used a dictionary he got when he went to law school. He used a Bible, and he used a book by Emmett Fox called Sermon on the Mount. And Sermon on the Mount, the last sentence in the foreword of that book says, any words that are capitalized imply God. Broad highway he's using here. He used the word creator a couple times. I meant to point it out as we were reading, but he used it in this paragraph as well. Nearness to our creator. Again, he's giving you ideas or thoughts about what could be the idea of a higher power, right? So this broad highway, this kind of roomy, all-inclusive idea is what he's given us here. Walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Again, capitalized. Again, implying God. Right. So these are some really, really nice promises, right? I mean, that's fears are falling from us. We might be beginning to have a spiritual experience, which is promised in the 12th step. Right? So this is the beautiful part about this whole thing. But the caveat is we've got to pocket the pride, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny, right? So there's some caveats here. Like, these promises are nice, but you gotta actually go to this depth to get there. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. There is, right there, your one time stamp in the big book, as far as how soon or how often on what timing to do something. There's the one, an hour after your inventory. Everything else it says, next, after, now, right? This is the one that gives us a little bit of breathing room, right? And why would we do something like that? Right? We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page where it contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? So when it says in the big book, it says we ask, that's a prayer, right? So it's asking us to pray these questions. And you can use them in a different context. It doesn't have to be exact. It's like, God, like, am I missing something? That's basically what that question is. Did I not read the directions properly and follow them the way that it was built and designed? It's like when you wind up building something from IKEA and you have like a bag of screws left over. right? It's like, God, are these really important? Yeah. Right? Like, or are these supposed to be extra? I can't read the language on the directions. Let's try to figure this out, right? But like, that's kind of the metaphorically what we're talking about. We're asking God if we had omitted anything. That's it, right? At that point, after the hour, you take the book down from the shelf. I like the way he's visually putting this, right? He's literally saying, have nothing in front of you. Bill had to put his iPhone down, right? It's like literally nothing in front of you. No book, no nothing. Quiet, meditation, reflecting, stuff that someone like me is A, not very good at, and B, not comfortable at doing. Even today, that 2 minutes sometimes feels like 20, right? So but it just depends. It depends where my mindset is. But when this is happening in the very beginning, when I sat with my sponsor and shared my inventory the day I got out of rehab, he told me to go basically sit in the corner for an hour, right? It felt like 10 hours. Looking at the clock. He's like, start praying. I couldn't really do it, right? But what I was trying to think if there was something that I was leaving out on purpose, right? Again, that's the whole the idea is, am I leaving it out on purpose, right? Yeah, so that's and then we bring the book down, and then we read the first five proposals, and then we really ask through with God's help, hey, like, for real now, is there something that I'm missing? Right? Again, this is vital, right? A life or death errand. Very important. If we can kind of place that emphasis on the newcomer, and we're not really going to scare them. I don't like the idea of like we could scare the newcomer. We've come from most of the sordid places on earth and scary, you name it, whatever, and just situations in life. Most of the time in our active addiction or alcoholism. So telling the newcomer that they could die from this thing, I don't think is necessarily as scary as we make it out to be. Again, depending on the person, we want to tailor it properly. But that being said, it told us in the book directly that this is a life or death errand. So now what? Right? Now we've shared this inventory. If we can answer to our satisfaction, we're on the top of 76. If we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. There's our third step drop again. Right? Remember in the third step? Tells us that we have to be willing to go to any lengths. Remember? And then he's reminding us in step six, oh, hey, remember. Right? We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Don't forget. Right? He drops a third step in every step from here on out. He just remember that decision that you made. Just remember that. And then you decided to take action because a decision without action is fantasy, right? So you've decided to do something and you're actually doing something about it. But we've got to remember that decision. We've got to be a kind of... I personally have to be reminded a lot, right? Once I'm reminded, it's like, oh yeah, right, that's why I'm doing this. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Right, we're now ready. Again, this is a question we're kind of asking ourselves at this point. It's like, okay, like, am I now ready for God to remove this stuff? Not for me to work on this stuff, but for me to have God remove them, meaning entirely, even the ones we like. Right, like the being able to like be dishonest to people's face, like stuff like that, or the, whatever, or the lust, or you name it, the gluttony, whatever it is that I can't be the only one that was hanging like that liked a couple of my character defects. I know I can't be the only one, you know. So it's like, and if you really think about it, there was some, you know, even if it's like, hey, what'd you have for breakfast? I had Cheerios, but no, I had like Raisin Bran. You know what I mean? It's like, why do we do that? There's a portion of us, right, that likes to hang on to and having certain control over certain things, and not telling 100% truth about something is our way of kind of controlling a situation, right? So it's like, that's me really what we're hanging on to. It's not that I like to lie, it's I like control, right? And again, when I control the bus, I run it right off the road, right into the ditch, right? So it's like, I'm playing God again when I do stuff like that. But we have to admit they're objectionable, right? We already did that in the fifth step. Remember, we admitted these things are objectionable. Now we're ready to have God remove them, okay? Can he now take them, every one? If we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. There you go, right? I like this one. Let me hang on to this one. All we have to do is, as we ask, again, as a prayer, God, help me be willing to offer this to you to remove it. You know, it's so it doesn't block us from moving forward. We're still involving God. We're just asking for willingness to remove this particular, whatever it might be, particular one or ten of them, whatever it is. We're as long as we're willing, when ready, we say something like this: My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. This is where now in the seventh step, we're lumping in the whole thing. Right, it tells us in how it works that we had to utterly abandon ourselves. We had to abandon what we had before. And this is what we're doing, good and bad. Right, up to this point, the inventory was kind of pointing out the more red letter items in our inventory. Now we're pulling in the whole thing. Right, the whole of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Who does that leave out? Me. I'm not asking you to remove my shortcomings to benefit me. I'm asking God to remove these shortcomings to benefit God and the fellows, the people around me. I get better on the back end of that whole deal. It's like I had one of my spiritual advisors, so he's like, you know, AA doesn't pay very well, but the benefits are amazing. Mm-hmm. Right? So we get the benefits on the back end of this whole thing, on a personal level. But on the front end, right, this is where we have to get right with our fellows and God, right? So this is in the seventh step prayer. It's literally telling me, like, it leaves me out of this entire situation, my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Again, I'm asking for strength to do God's work, God's bidding, whatever that is, whatever that might be. And I'm not privy to the plan. I don't get the directions and I don't get the playbook. Right, it's like a football player running out on the field, and they're starting to call plays. And I'm like, I don't know what the plays are. It's just you got to have faith, right, at that point, that you're going to be guided and directed in the proper way. You're going to have the right coach, right? And that's kind of where the on the field stuff comes from. The other people in AA, the fellowship, right, sponsorship, whatever it might be. So like, I don't get to call the plays. Right, some of the biggest tiffs in like sports history between athletes and their coaches is because the athlete doesn't think they're either getting the ball enough or calling the right plays. Right, so the athlete gets mad at the coach, and then the coach gets mad at the athlete because they're not performing the way they should be, and then there's friction. Right, it's the same kind of idea here. I'm really just letting God call all the plays and not getting mad about the plays that he, she, or it is calling. Right, but I'm willing again to have God remove these things and grant me strength. Right, not give it to me, but grant it. I'm not making him do it. It's like grant it to me. Right, it's funny, like the wording. We've got to make sure that we understand. Like I'm not saying God, you have to give me strength. It's like grant it to me if it's your will. Right, because I'm out to go do your bidding. We have to like nice. It's like we nicely ask for things from God. Like when my kids ask me for something, I ask them to tell me what's the magic word. Right, say please. Right, be nice. Be thankful. And when someone hands you something, thank them. Like it's the whole we're reverting back to kind of that mentality when it comes to God. It's like give me strength right now because I said so. It's like all right, you're playing God again. Right, maybe God doesn't see fit to give you strength in this moment right now. Maybe you need to be vulnerable and opened up a little. Right, but again, I'm not privy to the plan, so I'm not sure. Right, I can't speak that for you. I can't speak that for me. But I do know that there probably more than likely is some sort of plan. Because if there wasn't, I don't know if I'd be alive today. Still, there's a plan for us, right? And that's why in later on in the book, the chapter is like a vision for you, meaning you, the reader, right? Not a vision for me, but the vision for us, the reader. And that vision comes through God's eyes and God's will, not mine. Right, so then, and then do our bidding, amen, we have then completed step 7. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Right now, all of a sudden, it's like, that's not enough, we need more, right? We need more action. Faith without works is dead is a biblical quote, right? So the idea is that faith without the action, right, it is dead. So faith means nothing without putting action behind it. Right? I don't want to say means nothing because there is some sort of level of when we first walk into AA, right, that we have a level of faith that maybe they're going to teach me how to drink right, or they're going to teach me something. So they're going to, they've got something figured out that I don't. Like, that's kind of, I have a little bit of faith in that. Just like I have faith when I turn the light switch on, the lights are going to come on, right? So I have, there's a certain, a simple level of faith when we walk into AA, but again, without the action of walking into AA, right, there's no benefit of the program. So there's always associated, typically, with faith, a bit of action. Right? Again, the light switch analogy is the same thing. I can have faith that the light's going to come on, but I have to walk over there and flip the switch on. Right? I have some action to do. Right? So let's consider that. Like, faith by itself has something, but it's very transitory. It'll melt away rather quickly if we don't put some action to it. All right? Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and willing to, and whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. Oh, interesting. When people say I'm on step 8, oh, really? Tell me about that. Like, you're really not. It's already done. Right, to a degree, right? You can make separate lists, and we talked about it last week. Like, let's put it, okay, so these are harms that weren't like done to me, but I did something to them, and we can list them out. And my sponsor had me list them out in a different list in closest to a geographical location to where we lived. And he did that for a very specific reason, because after I made that other little list, the next day he drove me around to people that were close by to make amends to them. 25 days sober. Right? And 24 of those were in rehab, right? So that's the case. That's what he wanted. Put them in order, like close by, whoever's near, right? And so we can go make amends to them right away, right? So it says we subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, oh, here's my out, here it comes. We ask until it comes. Damn. So back to prayer again, right? Well, I'm asking. Again, we ask is a prayer in the big book, right? We ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Damn, step 3 again. There he goes. Drop it in. Because this is scary for a lot of people, and I get it. There was an amends that I made. I went back to upstate New York, which is where I did a lot of my, let's call it, damage, up in the Adirondack Park. And there was I worked at a veterinary hospital. You can imagine how that turned out. So I went to go, I called her up. Her name was Sue, the owner of the vet hospital. Sweetheart. Anyone that works with animals, the way that she just was, her heart is just massive. And the day she had to fire me was awful. Like, it was bad. And so I hadn't talked to her since. So I called her up and I got her on the phone. And I said, Sue, hey, I'm sorry to bother you. Just wanted to go over. She's like, oh my God, Mary. I didn't even get the sentence. Oh my God, how are you? I think about you all the time. Are you okay? Like, I'm doing great. I'd like to stop by and see you. I'm going to be in town in the next couple of days. Is it okay if I stop by? I forget what day. It was like a Tuesday or something. I was like, can I stop by like Thursday in the morning? She said, absolutely. No problem. I'll be there. You know, she's always there anyway. So I knew where to catch her. So on that Thursday, I'm driving there. And all of a sudden, I got this pit. We all know the pit, right? This fear, kind of like, oh my God, what am I? Am I really about to go do this? So I'm driving, probably 20 miles an hour. I don't even know, right? So I get there, I park the car, I turn the ignition off, and I just sit there. Meanwhile, my stomach is just churning. It's getting worse and worse and worse and worse. The anxiety is through the roof. I'm pit stains. I'm sweating. I'm going through it, right? Fear was physically manifesting itself in my body, right? Literal fear. Because the things that I did, right, could easily, someone could be like, yeah, I'm just going to call the police now and you can talk with them about this. Like, it wasn't pretty what went down there. And so That's all playing in my head. And again, I'm up here, right? It's just like a game of Pong. You know that game where the ball bounces back and forth? But like sped up to 100x. Just my brain is just, it's scrambled eggs, right? And so I open the door to the car, right? And I'm still sitting in the car. The door's open now. So I'm making progress here, right? I don't know how long I sat in that parking lot. I couldn't tell you. Get out of the car. I start walking up. I get really close to the front door. It's all really nice. It's like this big kind of almost like barn looking, but it's all done on the outside. There's flowers. I remember it like it was yesterday. Flowers everywhere. It's really beautifully done. And the dogs are barking in the kennel in the back. And I all of a sudden right in my stomach, and I lean over and I puke right in this flower bed right next to the door. Like I literally, fear was escaping me. It's like an exorcism. It was bad. And there wasn't a lot going on. It was like dry, and it was awful. Like my throat, it was bad, right? I don't think anybody saw me. And you'll see what happened after. So then I finally get the courage, and I go in, and you know, she pulls me in, and she gives me a huge hug. She's like this tall. She like literally jumps on me almost. She gives me a huge hug and like, you know, how are you doing? How are things? And it was like, great. How's your mom? And this and that. Because my mom, it's a small town USA. She brings all of her dogs there. My aunts bring all their dogs there. Their family, their friends, everyone brings. That's the vet hospital in town. It's like the little small town USA. And so we go in the back and we start talking. And I said, Sue, listen, like there's some things I got to talk to you about. You know, I stole from you. I took money from the till. I took narcotics from the lockbox in the back. You know, I did a lot of things. And whatever is needed for me to make this right, I'm willing to do it. And she said, are you in a 12-step program? And I said, yeah. And she said, what step is this? And I'm like, well, this is the 9th step. I'm you know, just trying to, you know, just let you know what exactly I did and, you know, and you know what I can do to fix it. And she goes, did you know my sister was a drug addict? And I said, and I didn't know that. And I said, no. Yeah, she passed away a couple years ago. She was in a bad car accident. She was drinking and driving, and luckily no one else was in the car. It was just a single car accident. And she said, I never thought the 12 steps worked. She's like, now you're. She started to cry, and I would get emotional thinking about it. She's like, now you're showing me that they do. You know? And it's like all this that I created up here. And then a moment of sitting in front of her and both two lives changed forever. Right? And she like just comes over, gives me a big hug, and I said, Sue, I gotta make it right. Like, there's something that I gotta do, right? I can't pay back all the money right now, and you know, I'd be willing to do a payment plan. She said, No. Here's what you're gonna do. Whenever you come back in to upstate New York, call me, and you can come volunteer at the animal hospital and walk the dogs for an hour. And I said, are you sure? And she said, yes, I'd love to see you and talk to you about how you're doing. Bring the kids, right? You know, so it's like, it was drastically different than I thought it was. And on the way out the door, I was like, Sue, I apologize. I kind of vomited over here in your flower bed. That's how she just like that, just a big, like, gut laugh. You know, and she's like, all right, you could start by getting the hose and spraying it. So I'm out there cleaning it up. But it's like, that's the, when it talks in the book about how, like, what's my thought process is like, and you know, having conversations in my head and not having them in real life because I think I know how they're going to go. Right? It just goes to show how God sees things so different. He played that out. It was like an orchestra, right? In the beginning, it's that intense music, and the, you know, and it's just, and then all of a sudden, like the light comes in, and it's just, and then it's just light from there. It's just so amends what they're talking about. Remember, we're willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. That's what we're discussing here. Just remember, right, how bad the pain was, right, and then the ability to show up. Right, and free someone else from what we did. That's what the goal is. My goal is to free them from me. Right, and again, we get the benefit of the amends on the back end of things. Right, later on, we get closer. We feel a nearness to our Creator in the 9th step promises. Right, remember that says we're painstaking about this phase of our development. We'll be amazed before we are halfway through. right? So, and that's the idea that comes around. Like, we might not be amazed the first half. We might be scared. And when my sponsor was driving me around the next day to the people that were within proximity, and by the people in proximity, that started with the people in my house, right? And he told me, he said, "Maren, make amends to the dog first in practice, right? Because you can't screw this up. Like, this is important." Right, we have to make sure you're not listing all the bad stuff you did, right? You're not necessarily, you're letting them know, like what ensued is, like, I wasn't a good employee with my wife. I wasn't a good husband, you know, before that boyfriend, fiance, husband. I wasn't any of those things. I wasn't able to show up, right? So to free the other person, that's the idea. On the bottom of 76, probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured, to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on the first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order. But this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose, right? If it says our real purpose, that implies that I have a fake purpose in my head. And here's the real one. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Right? That's when it comes to the amends process. That's exactly my real purpose. Again, I think is to make me feel better. Right? That's what I'm thinking in the beginning. Like, I can't wait to make this amends. I'm going to feel great afterwards. It's like, no, my real purpose is a little bit different. It's to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Anyone familiar with boxing, right? That's what he's referencing. You're not, your hands aren't up, blocking your chin. You're basically just like leaning in, like, go ahead, right? Let's see what you got. Not a good idea, for the record. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message. For our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. There it is. A sincere desire to set right the wrong, whatever that is. He is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than our talk of spiritual discoveries. Demonstration, that's another word for action. Right? So as long as we are in action, this person more than likely. And how is Bill, in writing this, and the people that help contribute, how do they know this? Because they went out and did it. They have experience with this. Right? A lot of them probably went out, and Bill even did this in the first 6 months before he met Dr. Bob. He'd go to bars and yell at people, say, "You've got to find God." It's like, well, whoa. Like, it's like, you know, you catch me with a few drinks in me, you say something like that, I might be throwing punches. You know what I mean? It's like, but again, that how they figured all this out was trial and error. That's great news for people like us. We don't got to go do that. Right? They did it for us. They kind of paved the path here and are giving us directions on what it is that we got to do. We don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God. When it would serve a good purpose, we are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. The question of how to approach a man we hated will arise. Now, when we get into the ninth step, what it does is it dives into different areas of people. Right? One of maybe the people that we hated. And then next are people we owe money to. It talks about debitors, right? And next is, and so the biggest main theme with all of this, and just something that we can keep in mind when making amends, we have to remember the step itself actually says we were to make amends, but when we're not injuring them or somebody else, right? So another example of this is on that, right before I took that trip to upstate New York, I called my sponsor. And before that, I had called my ex-girlfriend, right? And I said to her, "Hey, I'm going to be in upstate New York. You know, I'd like to sit down with you and just discuss a couple of things. It'll take 5 minutes. We meet wherever you want, coffee shop, whatever." And she said, and the way it was mentioned, and it didn't even cross my mind. She was like, "Oh, yeah, not a problem." And her now husband and boyfriend at that time, his name was Greg. And she said, "I'll just make sure Greg's at work." right? She just dropped it in. And I'm like, because I made like 20 calls to set up men's for that. So she was one of those calls. So I'm like, I'm trying to get this thing done and trying to line up kind of appointments for a men's. Well, I mean, it's 6 hours away. So it's like, I wanted to do as many as I could. So I called my sponsor. I'm super excited, right? I just made appointments for these men's, and I talked to my ex, and she said, we'll meet up when Greg's at work, and he was like, whoa, pause button. What was that? And I was like, well, her boyfriend is not a big fan of me, and she doesn't necessarily want him around. And he goes, well, let me ask you a question, right? Let's say you go and make amends with her, right? And everything goes great. Everything's good. Everyone's happy. Nothing weird, nothing crazy. Just everything is very, very normal, copacetic, and everything's fine. And then Greg, finds out that you were there, right? How is that going to be for their relationship? I was like, oh, I didn't think about that, right? So when to injure them or others is where that fell into play. He's like, I would call her and make sure he's allowed to be there if he wants to, whatever, but he's got to know. He just has to know. Right? So I was like, oh, fine. So right after I called her back and I said, hey, listen, just was thinking about it, what you said. It's okay if Greg is there, but you can't keep it from him. It's not like if he finds out, it's not going to be good. And she's trying to convince me he won't find out. It's like, and I was just like, all right, and I said, if you tell him, let me know. I'd feel more comfortable if he was actually there. It's fine with me. I'm okay with it, and she said, I'm not willing to do that. She was straight up, I'm not willing to do that. I said, okay. So to this day, I have yet to make amends to her, but the book tells me, like, I made an attempt, right? And if that attempt, but I didn't, see, again, without having, like, good counsel, I'm running up there and making the amends and thinking everything's good, and who knows? Now, today, they're married, and, like, I'm assuming, Facebook says they're happy. I don't know. So maybe that's true, maybe that's not, I don't know. But again, it's like, to have seeking counsel, and, my desire to set right the wrong was there. Like, my heart was in the right place, right? I wanted to do it, right? But it wasn't in the cards. Right, because I had somebody who was, he literally said, pause, when we were on the phone. He said, pause. What did you just say? And it was an interesting, and we laugh about this today, because he'll do that to me now, just because he's heard me speak a few times, and I bring this up, and he's like, just, oh, all right, pause. I'm like, stop, Chris. I'm too old for that. So again, it's like we have to know, and again, it says we use the kind of the God idea with tact and common sense, and we don't necessarily lead with that, and that's just so we don't prejudice someone from a later attempt, right? Again, there's a lot of nuances that go into this, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you like, hey, I've got answers for all of them, right? Because that would be kind of absurd, because the relationships that we cultivated or created before or destroyed before, right, have nuances, and they have different pieces to them. And so the suggestion is, and the amends process is, seek counsel, right, before we call, before we set those up. It also talks about there's going to be, people that we're unable, right, to see. So if finishing this paragraph, maybe he has done more to us. He's got me, we haven't approached this man in such a way we hate it will arise. And maybe he has done more to harm us than we have done to him. And though we have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. Any horse people, equestrian people out there? The bit is the metal piece that goes behind the molars of the horse that hooks and is to the reins, right? So when we take the bit in our teeth, it's literally telling us to let God direct us, right? Like, let God guide us in this. It is harder to go to an enemy than a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. That's a promise. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and express our regret. How about it? There you go. How about that for a deep cut amends? And he's leading off with this. He's leading off with the person we hate. And we might not have done anything to him. But there could be an ill feeling, or we express our regret, or an attached resentment to that person. Right? So again, it's about how far are we willing to go? What are we willing to do? Right? How free do you want to be? As my sponsor would say all the time. How free do you want to be? Are you willing to go do this? Right? If not, we ask for willingness. Okay, cool. Like, I'm not, or I'm not willing to do this. Okay, now your level of freedom is going to be deadened because of that. Right? You're allowing the obstacle to stay in the way. It's really what we're saying when we say, I'm not willing to make amends with this person because they're going to tell me this and that and that. There's one thing you're doing wrong already. You're having that conversation ahead of time. Right? I do it all the time. I'm going to have to talk to my boss about a raise. Or I'm going to talk to my boss about my day off. Or I'm going to talk about this. Okay, I'm going to say this. He's going to say this. I'm going to say this. And then whatever he says after that, I'm going to hit with this and this. It's like, that's absolute lunacy. In the nicest way possible. It's like, that's absurd. That's not, again, with amends, that's going to hurt us more than anything else. Because it's going to stop us. It's going to give us an excuse. A self-appraisal of that says, well, I'm not going to make that amends because they're going to say this, or they're going to say I'm not sober enough, or they're going to say whatever it is, right? So after the process, that day, my sponsor brings me back to the house. And he says, I think we made close to a dozen amends that day, including the people in my house, my kids, my wife, the dog. I count the dog, by the way. I count that one. And then he was the first one. And then he brings me back, and then he says, there's a lot of stuff we got to do. There's still some more amends you got to make. But the book, when it comes to step 10, which we'll get to next week, when it talks about, when we dive into step 10, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. Oh, snap. You mean to tell me step 9 is something that's going to continue and we start step 10 right away while we're doing step 9? That's what the book says. Right? So we commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. Right, so then step 10 is continuing to take that inventory, and we'll dive into that next week. So I think I'm at my time. So I appreciate you guys again. Thank you for having me. Thank you.